The question of the day is, will this hearing make a difference for Palestinians in the occupied territories, or is it just more hoopla from the international community? Well, I'd like to welcome my guests to the program. Alfred Dazayas, former Secretary of the UN Human Rights Council out of Geneva. And Kim Sharif, activist and lawyer out of London.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Well, thank you both for being with me. I'd like to start this off in Geneva with Alfred. Your perspective, how significant is this hearing on the Israeli occupation?
Personally, I believe that every hearing before the International Court of Justice creates precedents. And it is important to show that there is opposition, worldwide opposition, to the war that Israel is waging on the Palestinians, and in the manner in which this war is being waged, which is certainly genocidal. Now, for your listeners and viewers, you should understand that there are several proceedings in progress. The hearings of today that will go on all week and next week, Monday, are hearings on the request of the General Assembly for an advisory opinion on the question, legal consequences arising from the policies and practices of Israel in the occupied Palestinian territory, including East Jerusalem. Now, this is an advisory opinion, not to be confused with the pending contentious case under the Genocide Convention of 1948, which was submitted by South Africa and has garnered the support of countless countries, and not only in the global south. Now, what to expect? Certainly, the policies are apartheid policies. There is a long precedent of the International Court of Justice in the cases concerning Namibia and South Africa, etc. And the states that are participating in these hearings this week, a total of 53 states.
Stay with me, Alfred. Stay with me. I just want to, because we will get into some of this later on in the program, but overall, if I had to ask you, in your perspective, do you feel that this hearing is significant, very significant, or not?
I do think it is very significant because of the attention that it has garnered thus far, and because of the considerable number of states that are participating in the hearings.
Of course,
it is a moral, it will be a moral advisory opinion without the possibility of enforcement. So if you're looking for enforcement, look to the contentious cases which are legally binding.
Okay, stay now, with me. Stay with me, Alfred. Let me get Kim in on this conversation. Kim, this hearing comes a month after the one initiated by South Africa regarding the Zionist regimes committing genocide in Gaza. Is this a sign that there is a change on the horizon and that the Zionist regime is losing its impunity, or how do you assess it?
Well, it's good greetings to you, Ms. Hashimi, and thank you for inviting me on the program. It's absolutely harrowing events unfolding before our own eyes. It's like watching a nasty horror movie on a daily basis, and the whole world is being traumatized by this event, by these events. And of course, the actions of the state of South Africa, which is admirable, has brought the core issues of what's really going on into the attention of the world, and it's actually exposing the hypocrisy of the countries that were previously claiming to be upholding the rule of law under the international fora, which they weren't. And on the contrary, they're actually aiding and abetting genocide. There is no doubt that this is genocidal campaign. This is a systematic extermination of a specific group of people, which is horrific type of crimes against humanity. And whilst there may be issues and debates and considerations about how do we enforce the ultimate ruling of the court and how we go about doing that, that's another day's discussion. But the fact that the case was brought so hastily and with ample evidence and brought it to the court with the most formidable team of legal experts who have done an excellent job. I've watched the whole, in the entire proceedings, and I was very pleased to see such top-level advocates were dealing with the matter. And since the court has accepted that there is a prima facie case to answer for the charge of genocide, I think we can sit back and say, yes, there is hope that there is going to be a change in the international platform in terms of upholding the rule of law equally to all peoples of the world, okay, not to some people and like others. And I can go on to comment on the matter of the current hearing brought by the General Assembly. That itself is very important, because in this debate, we are, even though it's not legally binding, etc., etc., we are debating now and considering what has been going on for the past 70 years and more in terms of the behavior of the occupier. I mean, and then we go on to discuss the position of the people of the occupied. Are they resistance fighters or are they terrorists? That's a very important issue that needs to be debated and discussed, rather than allowing the countries that have been bullying the world for decades now and issuing sanctions and labeling everybody and anybody who disagreed with them on a very important moral issue like crimes against humanity and genocide and war crimes.
Okay.
This is what we have been discussing also in relation to Yemen, as you will recall, Ms. Hashimi. A lot of the wrongdoings were going on in Yemen as well. Yemen has had the misfortune of having medium-range nuclear weapon used on it in Ataun and Nakum, and it is alleged that it was done by Israeli jets. And that itself was never investigated and debated on the four world platform. So it is a great opportunity for the international community to have these cases debated now and determine once and for all what is really going on here.
All right. Okay. Stay with me, Kim. Stay with me, Kim. So sorry.
Okay.
But Alfred. Okay. So you were nodding your head with that when Kim was explaining various parts of her answer, because my next question is saying that basically this hearing, as you had already alluded to, is basically non-binding. So what is the significance? I think that Kim opened up part of that. I'd like to hear your explanation and expand on that.
Back in 2004, the International Court of Justice adopted an earlier advisory opinion on Israel, a school book example of a perfect advisory opinion listing all of the treaties that Israel had broken: the Covenant on Civil and Political Rights, the Covenant on Economic, Social and Cultural Rights, the Convention on the Elimination of Racial Discrimination, etc. The court also formulated very concrete, pragmatic recommendations, all of them ignored by Israel with the support of the United States, which has again and again abused the right of veto in the Security Council to shield Israel from any sanctions or any legal consequences. Matters are changing, though. It's a question of perception. I see that the United States and Israel are more and more isolated in the world. There is a global majority that supports the right of the Palestinian people to self-determination. This is a right that has been affirmed countless times by the General Assembly, by the Economic and Social Council, by UNESCO, even by the Security Council. But of course, in the case of the Security Council, when it comes to action, to enforcement, then you're certain to have a veto on the part of the United States. This brings me in with the momentum that I see. This is the moment for a group of states. We already say that there is consensus among countries like Algeria and Djibouti and South Africa, etc. Indonesia, by the way. It should be possible to submit a new application to the International Court of Justice against those countries that are complicit in the genocide. Obviously, if you deliver to Israel the weapons that are being used to perpetrate the genocide, you are complicit. You are doing it deliberately. You are making money on it. You know what you're doing. Article 3, little e, of the Genocide Convention makes the United States, the United Kingdom, France, Germany complicit in the genocide.
Can I just jump in here, Alfred? Sorry to interrupt. Can I just jump in here with what you're saying, that they would be complicit because they're going against actually something that the UN has already stated, the Security Council has already stated, especially today it was brought up about helping in the occupied territories and that it's against the law. At the end of the day, I want to know, does it make a difference? Will they have to pay? Can they stop these states from doing what they're doing?
Well, the United Nations does not have an army. The blue helmets are provided for by states when there is a decision of the Security Council. And you're not going to have a decision of the Security Council on this particular issue. But states can take individual action against the United States and against Israel. I think the time has come for 50 countries, 100 countries, 150 countries to break diplomatic relations with Israel because of the genocide, to indicate that they are not going to play the game.
Okay.
That they are not going to tolerate that genocide be occurring before our eyes.
All right, are we there though? Let me switch over back to London. Kim, do you think that we're there? Do you think that, as Alfred had said, that 50 states should cut ties with the regime and basically denounce it for the genocide is committing? Are we there yet? Because we know the price that they would have to pay via from the United States and the hegemonic bloc. I mean, your thoughts on that, Kim?
Well, yes, unfortunately, I totally agree with the idea of not only 150 countries, more than those. There's 193 member states in the UN. And so more than that need to get together and say, well, we don't want this to happen to us. Therefore, we will not allow it to happen to others like the Palestinian people. And the issue here is regime changes, sanctions, the usual bullying tactics that will be used by the regular bully boys at the UN Security Council. And a lot of countries will be frightened of that. And there's, of course, the issue of debts, debt reliefs and aid and all of that. But there is one brave country that has taken the stand and sought to enforce the UN opinion in terms of needing to prevent the genocide, and that's the Yemen. The Yemen's actions in terms of preventing ships going to Israel is partly this enforcement mechanism that the Yemenis, who have experienced the worst part of the failure to uphold the rule of law under the international system, have now learned the lessons from their own bad experiences, and now they feel for the people of Gaza, and that is why they're acting the way they're acting, even though we will be told here and elsewhere that they are a militia, terrorists, whatever, but we know that that is not true, that what they are preventing is ships going to Israel and coming from Israel, and they are upholding the rule of law pursuant to the ruling of the ICJ a couple of weeks ago, when they said that there is prima facie a case to answer for genocide, and it is well and proper for any country to step in and enforce that, because that is the rule of law. And of course, morally, it's just repugnant for countries to just sit back and do nothing. It is even more repugnant for other countries to create a land passage for food for Israel via Saudi Arabia and Jordan from the Emirates. And while the Palestinians are dying, I mean, they haven't, they can see what's going on. They know what's going on. These people have been starved, butchered. People are being killed inside hospitals. They are sick, lying in bed. They're being killed under gross misrepresentation about the nature of the people coming into the hospitals. Children, a child, Hind, age six, all her family, everyone who was with her in the car was already dead. The soldiers came and shot her as well. How can you supply food to that system and deprive the Palestinians from receiving any food? That is actually just repugnant. That's the only word I can find to describe the behavior of some of these countries. Mm-hmm. And I know, as a matter of fact, world opinion, world population is totally against them, and people think that they have now been exposed fully as ruthless, psychotic, psychopathic regimes that don't have empathy for any other human beings. They only are interested in their business deals and weapons deals and power and that kind of thing.
Right.
And,
well, let me just stop you there, Kim. You talked about upholding the rule of law. Yeah. And talking about the Yemenis. Alfred, I want to look at this because, as Kim just alluded to, there seems to be a transition between the world, the people, the population of the world, and world opinion. Because if we look at, for example, as she said, the Yemenis, who would be labeled by some as terrorists, but in reality, they are upholding the law. Or we see Hezbollah, who's another, it's another organization, it's called a terrorist organization, but they are also trying to stop this genocide. And we see, it seems to be going more towards a sharper vision of the reality that those who have used beautiful words and talking about human rights and women's rights and children's rights, but are actually being shown, as she said, to be the psychopaths that obviously when we're looking at this genocide today is taking place. And the opposite, though, is also true. How do you see that, Alfred?
Well, obviously, there's a lot of hypocritical rhetoric coming from Washington and London and Paris and Berlin, etc. I have my focus on Latin America, Africa, Asia, Indonesia, India. People have woken up. There is actually a change in progress. And same as Yemen has taken action, every other country in Africa, Latin America, Asia can also take action. For instance, there is a principle of international law called universal jurisdiction. And that means that when an Israeli official, military, someone who can be linked to the genocide travels outside of Israel, then that person can be arrested, can be tried, and can be sent to jail. I mean, that is happening more and more. Germany, for instance, has tried a number of Syrians who entered German territory, has convicted them of war crimes, etc. So here you have the exercise of universal criminal jurisdiction. Obviously, there is the International Criminal Court, and there is a case pending, submitted at the time by Algeria, Djibouti, and others against Netanyahu. But don't hold your breath, because the current prosecutor at the International Court of Justice, Karim Khan, is a Brit. And as far as I have seen, he advances the interests of the hegemon. And one of the first things he did is to stop the investigation of the International Criminal Court into the crimes of NATO armies in Afghanistan, whereas he continues the investigation of crimes committed by the Taliban. So you don't have, shall we say, an independent and a, shall we say, unbiased prosecutor in the International Criminal Court. But the respect that the International Court of Justice still enjoys, it's something that will not be wasted. I mean, right now, this is the moment to accumulate all of these statements by South Africa, by Algeria, by Indonesia in the International Court of Justice, and give it visibility. Unfortunately, as you know, I live in Switzerland, in Geneva. I am a U.S. and a Swiss citizen. I read the New York Times, the Washington Post, CNN, etc. Unfortunately, the kind of press coverage that the ICJ has been getting has been very slanted, very biased, and almost upset that something like this could be happening, that Israel would be before the International Criminal Court or before the International Court of Justice.
Right. Why aren't we surprised? Why aren't we surprised, Alfred, with that? Let me cross back over to London and Kim. You know, Kim, the reality is that there's a lot more conversation happening, talking about Israeli accountability. But at the end of the day, as we talk, as we sit here right now on this program, Palestinians are still being killed in this genocide in Gaza. 4.5 months later, it still has not stopped. Your thoughts, Kim. The end of the day, what is it going to take to stop it?
Well, it is unfortunate. It is very unfortunate. Perhaps it's the will of God that it goes on like this, so that the masks can be exposed of a whole load of hypocrites on the world international fora, and expose them for what they really are, just hypocrites. And what we need to do also is have a network of lawyers, international lawyers, who will vigorously uphold the rule of law in the best way they can in all their jurisdictions worldwide as a backup system, in addition to other countries taking measures as the Yemen did. And of course, that may send a message that not only the criminal regime is at risk here in terms of prosecution and being brought to trial, there's also those who are aiding and abetting it. Because there is a duty to prevent genocide, right, not to sit back. And you can see also the inconsistency in how the rules were applied by the said bully boys of the Security Council. You've seen what happened in Rwanda. We've seen what happened in Bosnia.
30 seconds, Kim. And then we've seen what happened. 30 seconds.
Okay.
Go ahead. Sorry.
And then we've seen what happens in Ukraine. So the international community, the people of the world, Africa and Asia and elsewhere, have now woken up to the reality that they don't matter. Do you see where I'm going? And therefore, they need to now step forward and do something about this, because they do matter. Everybody matters. Every human being's life is precious. And may God be with the people of Gaza and end this suffering as soon as possible.
And a perfect note to end this program with. Thank you both for being with me on the spotlight. Alfred Dzayas, former Secretary of UN Human Rights Council out of Geneva. Kim Sharif, activist and lawyer out of London. Thank you for being with us on another Spotlight. I'm Marzia Hashimi. Goodbye.
In Insights into the Holy Quran.
Indeed, this Quran guides to what is most upright and gives the good news to the faithful who do righteous deeds, that there is a great reward for them.
In the name of Allah, the Compassionate, the Merciful, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, Assalamu Alaikum. Welcome to another edition of the program, Insights into the Holy Quran, by Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Mudarrisi, a graduate of the Hawza Seminary of Qom. Please stay with us.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم. In the name of Allah, the most compassionate, the most merciful. Hello everyone, brothers and sisters. I am Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Mudarrisi with you with another edition of Insights into the Holy Quran. In this edition of the program, we'll discuss some of the contents of chapter Naml, the 27th chapter of the Holy Quran, as well as some of the commentary points of the verses. Dear listeners, let's listen to the first to third verses of the chapter.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم.
In the name of Allah, the entirely merciful, the especially merciful.
طاسين. تلك آيات القرآن وكتاب مبين.
Ta-seen. These are the verses of the Quran and a clear book.
هُدًى وَبُشْرَى لِلْمُؤْمِنِينَ.
As guidance and good tidings for the believers.
الَّذِينَ يُقِيمُونَ الصَّلَاةَ وَيُؤْتُونَ الزَّكَاةَ وَهُمْ بِالْآخِرَةِ هُمْ يُوقِنُونَ.
Who establish prayer and give zakah, and of the hereafter they are certain in faith.
Now, regarding these verses, we discuss the terminology used in these verses. We discuss the word zakat, also the word mubin, that is both transitive and intransitive, and also the application of the word tilka in the verse, which states and denotes the greatness of these heavenly verses. And because the word mubin is used for the Quran, it means that it's emphasizing and indicating that Quran is both clear and making things clear. So, in the second noble verse, as we said, there are other qualities mentioned for the Quran. هُدًى وَبُشْرَى لِلْمُؤْمِنِينَ. A guidance and glad tidings. But the point is that these two actually qualities of the Quran are not for everyone. They are for the believers, hudan wa bushra, but not for all the people, for mu'mineen, the Quran says. So this means that these mu'mineen, who are believers in the Almighty Allah and hereafter, have their belief firm in the origin and resurrection. Their link with Almighty Allah is strong. So, therefore, these qualities point to both their complete faith and their practical, inclusive program. Now, there may arise a question here that if these believers have chosen a straight path from the point of basic doctrines and practice value, and both, actually, why is it necessary that Quran comes for their guidance? Aren't they already in the right path? Haven't they chosen monotheism? Haven't they chosen Almighty Allah and His side? Now, to answer this, we need to pay attention to one point regarding to the fact that guidance consists of different stages, each of which is a preparation for the higher stage, and higher stages, actually, the answer of this question is made clear. And moreover, the continuation of this guidance is itself another important matter, which needs to be discussed in its place.
على مر الزمان تألقا وأضاء للدنيا طريقا.
We hope and pray that Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala blesses us with the ability to cover more of His divine
In this
word.
Series of programs, we will inshallah discuss the Holy Quran with a thematic approach.
We will inshallah discuss the chapter.
حفظ الكتاب بصدره فبدا وضيئا كالنجوم تألقا وتمثل القرآن في أخلاقه وفعاله فيه الفؤاد تعلقا وتلاه في جنح الدجى متدبرا.
The context in which Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala speaks in this verse is the context of mentioning the ills and problems and evils of the people of the book, the previous nations who have received revelation, and more particularly the Jew.
Now let's listen to some of the verses of the Holy Quran.
First, let's listen to a few verses.
Now let's listen to some verses of the Holy Quran.
Insight into the Holy Quran by Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Mudarrisi, a graduate of the Hawza Seminary of Qum.
So, dear listeners, since these are mu'minun, it doesn't necessarily mean that they do not need the Holy Quran and its guidance. They do need the guidance of the Holy Quran, even if they are mu'min. Why? Because they need to complete and they need to get their utmost perfection. They have the ability, they have the capacity of reaching that highest levels of perfection. And Quran is there for this. So, it is the same thing that by saying, اهدنا الصراط المستقيم, guide us, O Lord, unto the right path. In our old daily prayers, we ask Allah that He subhanahu wa ta'ala makes us fix in His way and He continues it. Because without His grace, this continuation, this staying in the right path is impossible. And besides that, taking the advantage of the verses of the Quran and the book manifest is possible only for those who carry the soul of seeking the truth in them. Of course, they might not have obtained the complete guidance yet, but this is the nature of the Quran. It guides people. It guides the ones who have chosen to be in the right path. If we see that in one occurrence, the Quran has been introduced as the origin of piety of the pious. In another occasion, it's been introduced as the source of guidance for the Muslims. And here, as the cause of guidance for the believers, one of its reasons might be that a person will not go after the reality unless at least a stage of piety, submission, and belief in reality exists in his heart. And a disbeliever does not enjoy the light of this manifest book because the eligibility of the place is also conditioned. Thank you for staying with us. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Don't be saddened by what you see, by all the lies and treachery. Life is cruel, but don't worry. In your heart lies the key to unwind all the secrets. This life we see.
Thank you, dear listeners of IRIB English, for listening to us. If you have any question regarding our programs, feel free to email us at englishradio@irib.ir. Also, visit our website, at parstoday.com. Until the next program, take care and goodbye.
Things always worked for me, worry ends when faith begins.
We are with you. What about you? IRIB English Radio.
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Rubashavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Pereza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
Saeed Aminolemi, Kabul.
Shahana Bhatt, Indian administered Kashmir.
Around the world with reporters.
As the assault on Gaza escalates again with the death toll since October 7 nearing 30,000, pro-Palestinian protests are gaining momentum in Canada. During nationwide rallies, protesters criticized Prime Minister Justin Trudeau for his inaction.
Palestinian.
On the cusp of the Israeli invasion of the southernmost city of Gaza, Rafah, the people of take to the streets, joining cities across Canada, calling on their government to take measures to stop Israel's genocide of the Palestinian people.
I'm here to ask for ceasefire right now. Enough is enough. It has been taking a long time for our government to stand up and call for ceasefire. This is not the right way to do it. We have to get arms embargo.
I'm at a loss for words, to be honest, but what's going on, it's the end of the line. It's a death camp, and we want to, again, pressure our politicians, pressure our communities, hands off Rafah.
Although the government of Canada has called for a ceasefire, demonstrators noted that since October, Ottawa has approved $28.5 million of military exports to Israel. They see this, along with the refusal of the Canadian government to call the assault on Gaza genocide, tantamount to a stab in the back of the public's demands. Robert N. Lakesh, Calgary.
Tens of thousands of farmers are standing their ground on the outskirts of New Delhi ahead of planned crucial talks. The Farmers' March comes 2 years after similar protests that lasted for a year against new agricultural reforms that were later scrapped by the government of Premier Modi. As general elections are due in the coming months, the farmers are mounting pressure on the government, demanding legislation that would guarantee minimum support price for their produce.
We are protesting to guarantee prices for our crops. The previous government had schemes in support of farmers, but the present government is making laws which are against farmers and not acceptable to us. They want to sell India's agriculture sector to corporations, but we will protest till our demands are met.
The protesting farmers are mostly from the neighboring state of Punjab and Haryana. They say rising cultivation costs and debts have led them to increase their production of crops. Therefore, a guaranteed minimum support price for their produce would stabilize their income. They're also demanding the government fulfill its election pledge to double farmers' income and waive their loans and withdraw any legal case filed against them during earlier protest.
This government wants to destroy us. All the promises before elections turned futile. We want debt waivers, pensions for farmers and laborers, and the withdrawal of all legal cases filed against protesting farmers during the 2021 March. We are peacefully marching towards the capital, but the government is using tear gas to stop us as if we are outsiders, but we will fight till our demands are fulfilled.
Since the march started, several meetings between leaders of farmers and government ministers have ended inconclusively. The ministers of Modi's government, however, expect a peaceful solution. The two sides are expected to meet soon, as Prime Minister Modi has already said his government is working on more inclusive schemes to benefit farmers. His party also claims to have already doubled the minimum support price from 1,000 to 2,000 Indian rupees, a claim that farmers deny. The protests come at a time when the country is gearing up for general elections in few months' time. The farmers are seen as an important section of the voting population. Experts say Modi is expected to secure a third term, despite the protest. They say it is, however, crucial to strike a deal with the protesting farmers to secure a long-term solution, since successive governments have failed to appease them.
Most of the vital roads leading to the capital, New Delhi, have been fortified, like this one. And massive barricades have been erected across all sides of the border to make sure the protesters are confined to outside the city. Tens of thousands of farmers are camping just a few miles away from the capital. They say they will keep marching to the capital unless there is a breakthrough in negotiations. Munawar Zaman, New Delhi.
Anger in the streets of London. Another mass protest. A turnout of hundreds of thousands. Veteran campaigners, young activists, British Jewish groups.
It's the fourth national demonstration of the year and the second one to end outside the Israeli embassy here in London. And their message, these protesters say, is clear. Stop the genocide now.
That's what they have been demanding for more than 4 months now. And the impending Israeli incursion into the southern Gaza city of Rafah, that shelters more than 1.5 million Palestinians, accounts for today's turnout, one of the largest since it all began.
We're watching these messages, we're watching these videos of people getting slaughtered on a daily basis, but we're not insensitized to this. The Western media, the Western world is desensitized to this. Well, we won't. We will stand for our Palestinian brothers and sisters in Gaza, in the West Bank, wherever, to get rid of this cancer that is Zionism, and we're going to fight until the day that Palestine is free.
A free Palestine is yet to come. But there is a chance for British politicians to stop the ongoing mass slaughter. On February 21st, MPs, representatives of the British public, will be voting on a second ceasefire motion. The first such vote, November last year, didn't pass muster. We asked Ben Jamal of the Palestine Solidarity Campaign what message a no vote would send to the Palestinians.
It will deliver a message to the Palestinian people that the British Parliament says your lives don't matter. The message we've delivered today is that they do matter to the British people, and that now the British Parliament needs to start listening to what the British people are saying.
The political party's position on Israel's genocidal war on Gaza has taken center stage in this year's upcoming general elections in the UK. And the protesters here say it determines which way their vote will go. Saeed Purizap, London.
Supporters of the jailed Pakistani former Premier Imran Khan and his party, Pakistan Tehreek-e-Insaf or PTI, held nationwide protests on Saturday to condemn alleged manipulation in the February 8 general election.
The mandate that the people of Pakistan has given the independent, so-called independent candidates, backed by none other than PTI, because our election symbol was taken away, our entire leadership is behind jails with sham, aapke jo mukadmaat hai. So this doesn't make any sense. When the people have spoken, they have to be respected. Otherwise, they will be on the street, it will be chaos, and no government, no political party will be able to rule.
Supporters of Imran Khan's party insist that widespread electoral manipulation has deprived their party of achieving two-thirds majority in the parliament.
I voted for Imran Khan, but I'm speaking as a Pakistani voter. I voted, I was there at 7:45 in the morning. I wanted to be first in line so that I could vote. By evening, our candidate was winning, everything was fine. 3 a.m, suddenly the man lost, and he lost by 20,000 votes or God knows something like that. How is this possible? This is not possible and this is not acceptable.
However, Imran Khan's rival political group, Pakistan Muslim League Nawaz, says the PTI party tried to derail democracy by creating controversy around elections. A dramatic change in the political climate occurred when the commissioner of Rawalpindi, a city in northern Pakistan, tendered his resignation, citing a guilty conscience for his role in enabling widespread electoral manipulation in the garrison city.
We converted the losers into winners with 70,000 votes margin. The Chief Election Commissioner and Chief Justice are involved in poll fraud. I accept all the responsibility. I should be hanged. I cannot participate in the crime that could destroy Pakistan.
This is while Pakistan's Election Commission has rejected claims made by the Rawalpindi Commissioner, stating that no official of the electoral body gave any direction to him regarding the manipulation of results.
The outcry over alleged vote rigging in the recently held elections for national and state legislatures has sparked widespread protests among multiple political factions. Analysts warn that the absence of a clear mandate for any political party could lead to prolonged political instability and hinder efforts to address economic challenges of the country. Nasir Kazmi, Islamabad.
Guarding the homeland against the threats from above. Iran's defense ministry has unveiled advanced air defense systems, further strengthening its position as one of the few countries that have acquired the technology involved in the detection, tracking, interception, and destruction of attacking missiles, both long-range and short-range.
Today, we are witnessing major achievements that have significantly increased our defense capabilities. The Arman anti-ballistic missile defense system is named after martyr Arman Aliverdi. It is classified as a tactical air defense system. Arman is equipped with a domestically made Sayyar 3 class, and it is capable of simultaneously detecting and tracking 24 targets at a distance ranging from 120 to 180 kilometers.
This new cutting-edge defensive weapon is also equipped with a self-protection system that makes it immune to potential low-altitude threats. The Arman defense system's radars and missile launchers have been incorporated into a single vehicle to enhance agility in defensive operations, allowing it to engage in operation in less than 3 minutes.
Azarakhsh, the other system we are unveiling today, is a low-altitude defense system. It's considered a versatile defense weapon that can be installed on different types of vehicles. This adds to its mobility and makes it ideal for agile responses. Therefore, it can be used to provide security for protected areas.
The state-of-the-art technology applied in both of the newly unveiled military hardware enhances defensive posture and boosts deterrence to adversary aggression, significantly increasing Iran's air defense capabilities once they are added to the country's military fleet.
What you witness today is quite significant because defensive capabilities and air defense in particular can tip the scales in any aggression and war. That is why this kind of deterrence is crucial for our country, a lesson that we learned the hard way because before the Islamic Revolution, we used to import everything from other countries.
Iran has made remarkable breakthroughs in manufacturing a broad range of homegrown military hardware in line with the policy to strengthen its defense capabilities, a red line that will never be up for any kind of negotiation.
Iran has come a long way over the past 45 years in its defense capabilities, becoming fully self-sufficient, turning from a country that had to import the military hardware that it needed to one that today is producing all the military equipment that it needs and also developing new ones. Gisum Shahmadi, Tehran.
In the United States, Congress has broken for winter recess without coming to an agreement on a nearly $100 billion weapons package, which would have funded wars in Israel, Ukraine, the Red Sea, Taiwan, and elsewhere for years. The bill had passed the Democrat-led Senate, but the Republican-majority House of Representatives refused to vote on it in a setback to President Joe Biden's war planning.
Let me be clear here again this morning. The Republican-led House will not be jammed or forced into passing a foreign aid bill that was opposed by most Republican senators and does nothing to secure our own border.
Earlier this month, Biden unsuccessfully tried to force through a $120 billion war spending bill, which even cynically tried to win over Republicans with $20 billion in anti-immigrant border security spending. While top polling agencies have remained mostly silent on the issue so far this year, the most recent polls confirm that public support has plummeted for more weapons to fuel foreign wars. There is an increasingly vocal desire to end American warmongering abroad and to focus money, energy, and attention on the raft of post-pandemic and post-great financial crisis domestic problems.
The situation here on the ground is definitely can be radicalizing because people are not even being provided with any of the usual concessions that imperial nations oftentimes, you know, give their citizens to keep them distracted. They're just being left out there while, again, we are giving billions and trillions to other countries to fight wars that are supposedly on our behalf, and yet we don't get to have any input in that.
The Biden administration has repeatedly rejected any negotiated settlement to the Ukraine conflict and has no strings attached to its unshakable support of Tel Aviv. Many say it's just a matter of time before more weapons are eventually sent to Israel and Ukraine, despite the global outcry.
We have to remember that these wars go on until America is defeated. Eventually, the public turns against every war. The war keeps going until it's no longer useful to big business, and it's no longer useful to defeating our rivals and corralling world energy resources.
The failed bill explicitly prohibited any funds for the United Nations Relief and Works Agency for Palestine Refugees, which is the main humanitarian agency in Gaza. Ramin Mazahiri, Chicago.
Agreements marking a significant step forward in enhancing economic relations between Iran and Armenia. 19 MOUs that lay down the framework for expanding mutually beneficial bilateral cooperation in a wide range of areas. Iran and Armenia's economic relations have consistently strengthened over the past couple of years, with bilateral trade reaching $1 billion U.S. dollars, and now both sides are ready to take it to the next level.
For both our countries, there is great potential to boost trade, and we are adamant about using all the capacities to expand our relations. I have to note that promoting political and economic relations with Iran has been high on the agenda of the government of Armenia. We attach great importance to our relations with Iran in all fields.
This is all in line with agreements to increase bilateral trade in two phases made in 2022 during the Armenian Prime Minister's visit to Tehran.
According to the agreements made in 2022 and the first phase, we set a target for a trade volume of $1 billion. And now we are taking the necessary measures to increase that by threefold. In order to reach this objective, we are signing agreements that cover 19 areas of economic cooperation.
The recently signed Eurasia Free Trade Agreement is expected to facilitate the implementation of these MOUs by eliminating customs duties. So, we are on the right track.
These developments come at a time when Iran has been an anchor for peace, with sparks of tension every now and then between Armenia and Azerbaijan turning into an issue of concern. Therefore, in the big picture, these scenes could translate into measures that go beyond traditional rhetoric, encouraging stability in the region.
Iran and Armenia are taking practical steps to expand business and trade relations, taking their economic ties to the next level, at a time when these ties seem crucial to establish peace and security in the region. Gisum Shahmadi, Tehran.
Allah, 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 Allah.
چیزی که انسان را مطمئن می کند ذکر خدا ذکر الله تطمئن القلوب.
Be aware, the hearts find rest in Allah's remembrance.
Spring of truth.
Allahu ya Allah subhanallah. Allahu ya Allah walhamdulillah. Allahu wa la ilaha illa Allah. Allahu ya Allah wallahu akbar.
Date February 8, 1983. Subject: Importance of cohesion of the Air Force with Islam, divine favors in the victories of the nation of Iran. At the court of the blessed and almighty Allah, you are held high and are valued for smashing this barrier at a difficult time, and following you, the rest of the armed forces also joined with the nation, so that thank Allah this victory was achieved and the evil Taghut was transformed into the compassionate. You who at the time were serving the evil Taghut are from that day onwards in the service of Islam and in the service of the blessed and almighty Allah. The victory that was attained for you and the armed forces from the beginning of the revolution until now cannot be regarded as an ordinary feat. You know what a power we were confronted with at the start of the revolution, a power that was armed in the course of long years, although they had not armed it for Iran, but had armed it to confront the enemies of America, and you know that all the powers were backing it and were aiding it.
In the name of Allah, the most compassionate, the most merciful. On the subject of the Islamic Revolution, Imam Khomeini rahmatullah alayh said, as long as America has not gone away and the hands of these superpowers have not been taken off our country, our movement shall continue, and so shall our cries, and we shall continue our task, and God willing, we shall succeed. Well, Imam Khomeini rahmatullah alayhi in this viewpoint is addressing the issue of imperialism and the way Islamic revolution in Iran rejected it. You know, on the national level, the revolution in Iran brought together Iranians of all backgrounds to collectively oppose the Pahlavi regime and its American enablers, which rendered the Shah's military strength and the US backing especially irrelevant. It is a brilliant example of indigenous popular will triumphing over imperialism.
طه النبي وآله
صلى الله عليه
صل يا
رسول الله
يا ربنا صل على طه النبي وآله.
On a global level, the revolution's core message of Islamic unity and anti-imperialism resonated deeply outside of Iran and served as an arguably modular approach for other societies to emulate in their quest for justice, dignity, and independence as well. The Islamic revolution challenged the conventional wisdom regarding revolutionary movements, which maintained that religion was not an important or critical factor in modern political struggle. The neither East nor West stance of the Islamic Republic also challenged the Cold War era nation that were only two recognized and acceptable political blocs, and powerfully illustrated how a non-aligned nation could chart its own political and social destiny while maintaining its rights. Moreover, the elimination of the United States' presence in Iran and constant meddling in Iran international politics marked a new era of anti-imperialism